So my task is to tell you a little bit in particular about how the research councils are going to implement the recommendations of Dame Janet's committee that were indeed accepted by the government. I'm going to start briefly with a few comments about the need and benefits of open access, some of which haven't been made, very briefly on green and gold, which are very familiar terms to some in the audience but less familiar to others. Then I'll talk about the implementation. Of course, the latest version of the guidance has come out this very morning, has been provided by Dougal to the audience, so you'll be able to see it. Then some items of discussion. Something a little on the CC BY licensing, which applies to open access, because we think to gold open access, the author pays, because we think that's very important. And then finally, looking more at the opportunities that the availability of open access literature provides. And that's where I'd really like us to be looking in the future, because that's why it's so exciting. Clearly, at one level, there has been a market failure. If you imagine a reverse process in which we started with free open access, and then it was proposed that we make it all only behind a paywall, which you would have to pay for the privilege of finding now access to all these publicly funded activities, you can correctly assume that the reaction would be one of outrage. So what we're hoping is by doing the process in the reverse direction, the reaction will be one of joy. And the first two points have been made by Dame Janet. For researchers, and the point two of the time, I'm still one, and we'll go back to being one in the autumn. There is quite a lot of literature showing that for a researcher, the open availability, there is an open access citation advantage, which varies quite widely between discipline and country and a whole bunch of things, but is often quite substantial. There's quite a literature on that. I do find it very odd that the term is referred to as publication when it clearly isn't anything of the sort when it's behind a paywall. But from my perspective, the number of papers peer-reviewed in PubMed, so the biomedical literature, per minute being published is 2 per minute, 1 million a year. The whole peer-reviewed literature is 5 a minute. No individual, obviously, can read that, but computers can. If you let computers read them, you can buy yourself science that you couldn't otherwise buy intellectually by any other means. That is the really key thing from my perspective, and also that requires, however, that a license that allows you to do all the clever stuff is made available, and that's part of the gold open access. Janet mentioned the international context. I can't stress too much how important this is. We are not alone. Everyone else is doing flavours of these kinds of activities, both in terms of mandators, such as Horizon 2020, and funders, and countries as a whole. Many of them have been doing it for quite some time, and the mandate in the US was mentioned from the OSTP, but already about 100 million a year is being spent by the National Institutes of Health in open access publication, and the NSF about 25 million. So these are not small sums, and the Global Research Council is going to have a long debate on this in May. So, as Janet discussed, for a whole variety of reasons that were gone through in both the report and Janet's super talk, gold is the only realistic way for sustainability for the entire ecosystem. But nevertheless, there are benefits to having green as well, and it is an as well in the mixed economy. And so what came out was how you, in terms of how you would implement this, is the recognition that if you are going to have article processing charges paid, then you should actually have all of the benefit of having free and open and unfettered access to the gold open access articles, the so-called CC BY licensing, I'll talk a little bit about it later, which allows unfettered reuse with attribution, key aspect of that. And there's some other aspects of it too, like you shouldn't just diss the thing because you don't like it. If a publisher chooses not to make a gold option available, then green open access is admitted with an embargo, initially of up to 6 months for the STEM subjects and 12 for arts and humanities. But if the money's run out from the gold open access from the money that research councils and others are making available, then a longer embargo period is admitted. It is, however, seen that anything much beyond 2 years of delayed access is not really within the spirit of open access. We recognise that compliance will not be instantaneous, and, as Janet said, a very rapid transition would likely destabilise the ecosystem in an unnecessary way. But nevertheless, actually, most journals of interest are actually compliant now. One could also comment, of course, and Janet did, that gold open access is already very widespread, and PLOS ONE being a particular example. Again, the gold journals do not see green as something antithetical to them. They find it actually complementary, all assisting dissemination. So a decision tree has been made available that allows one to work out the optimal way through these thickets, and it's a pretty simple one. If the research has been publicly funded and there is a gold open access option available with article processing charges, you're then expected to take it. If it is not, then you can go green after an embargo of 6 months. If the funds are available from the grants that have been made to various HEIs, then immediate gold open access is mandated, whereas if they're not, then we accept there should be a longer delay, at least initially, of 12 to 24 months, depending upon the subject. As will be mentioned several times, and already was by Janet, this is not an instantaneous transition. Open access has been around, actually, for quite a long time. The RCUK implementation is a journey, not an event, and some of the recent events are listed here. In September, BIS handed out 10 million to Pump Prime, the initiation of setting up publication fora within HEIs and the like, making money available, and our own announcement on the block grants that will be made available to institutions came out in November, and that will start from the 1st of April. An enormous amount of consultations have gone on with every interested party, and Janet listed how very many there are, and we've had a select committee inquiry just recently. And this very day, the revised guidance has come out, with a two-week chance for people to send in any comments if there are some very obvious banana skins that still remain, and people are invited to do that. And then we recognise, because it is quite a complex and uncertain ecosystem, that a full evidence-based review should and will be done, and that will be done towards the back end of 2014. So we recognise that this is a transition, and it's going to take a certain amount of time, and in the absence of any real knowledge, the number 5 years has been mentioned as something that might be the sort of time it would take. That's not an aim. Personally, I hope it would be quicker, but that's the sort of number that people see as a reasonably realistic aspiration. The sort of sums that are involved, funders do recognise correctly that the cost of dissemination is as much a cost of doing the research as is buying a pipette or a mass spectrometer. And the sort of numbers that appear to be the ones that are actually true in terms of current gold open access publishing costs is that about 1 to 1.5% of the cost of doing the research is involved in disseminating it. The 11 billion is the sort of sums that all of the research councils together have between about, I think, 2011 to 2014-15. So the sorts of 1% of that is obviously 100 million. And so what we've agreed to do as research councils collectively is to pay block grants to institutions. We debated whether or not it should be attached to each grant. That was decided to be a bit too messy for a whole bunch of reasons, including the fact that often the publication is sometime after the end of the grant, and therefore tying it too closely to individual grants doesn't make a lot of sense. And so institutions, as Janet said, were expected to set up publication funds, not only using our money, but using other monies that become available from other sources to make this thing happen. And we're trying to be pretty flexible about how they spend that money, while recognising that we do really expect that a good fraction of it would be actually spent on paying the article processing charges to assist the immediate availability of the research that's been funded. some fairly detailed calculations were done using numbers that are easily available, how many publications are being made, what the average APC was and so forth, and you can work out therefore what it is that you ought to be putting into the block grant if you're going to get a certain level of compliance, which we estimated to be 45% at the beginning, moving in 5 years to 75%, hopefully even more, but these are the sort of numbers that you put in when you do the calculation, and the numbers are merely the product of the number of papers, the average APC, and the degree of compliance, and so those are the sorts of numbers that come out when you do that. They're distributed on the basis of the direct costs of employing postdocs and the like who write the papers on research grants, and so it's actually a ZIF distribution, it's a logarithmic distribution. So the ones on the left of that graph, the most get 7% or so of the total block grant, and then it goes down with a very, very long tail, and we cut off the tail at £10,000 for any individual institution. So you can see that there is still quite a long tail of people who are getting something, but it clearly favours the research-intensive institutions. Separately, research councils with institutes are looking after them in a similar kind of way. Those numbers do not appear on that graph. Because there's lots of things potentially going on at different times, and there are some things that we want to do to assist the thing, you don't really want to have every researcher wasting their time wading through the literature to find out if journal X, Y, or Z is compliant or not. You want to have a website that tells them in one go. So things like that are going to be done to make it easy for people to see what is going on. We're working with people in Nottinghamshire, Peromeo, and the Trust and GISC to do that. We also don't want an unnecessary lot of reinvention of wheels, so we're working with Research Information Network and HEIs to develop what looks like the best and easiest way of setting up these kinds of repositories and article processing activities within institutions. And we recognise that the learned societies are important stakeholders, and the truth is that some are more advanced than others in their thinking, and we'd like to get them all together to try and share best practice there too. And I've mentioned those two other points already. Now coming to CC BY licensing. If we have paid for, and institutions have paid, an article processing charge, what it means is we want the material to become utterly available in a completely unfettered manner, including for commercial reuse, but with attribution. And that's referred to as CC BY in the Creative Commons licensing pantheon. The CC BY license comes with various things that stop it being plagiarism, and they stop it being misused. I'll just put it in those terms. And CC BY is just the simplest method of allowing reuse, what I refer to as Hargreaves plus plus, for those who know about the Hargreaves review that we're also promoting the liberalisation of this kind of work. Also, if you say that something's a non-commercial license, there's a flavour of CC BY called CC BY NC for non-commercial, it's not entirely clear what that means, because universities, are they commercial entities? Interesting question. They would probably like to think so. I'd also stress that the CC BY license with attribution does not affect third-party rights. If you have published something for which you have obtained a license to someone else's material, when you publish it with CC BY, that doesn't nullify the original license that carries through with it, and you therefore don't waive any third-party rights when you do this. And the reality is, this is the way in which Gold OA is implemented now by all the people who've been pioneering it. Also, in addition, we require in papers that acknowledge Research Council funding a statement on access to how you can get the underlying materials. And it all helps the transparency of the scientific process, which, of course, benefits science itself, that it should be easy to reproduce and the like, all the sciences things. And the Royal Society's report on that had something to say about that. And finally, I'm just going to look at the question of all the benefits that we can have from doing this. And the first question to ask is, well, if you're a biologist, you can go to PubMed and you can read all the abstracts for free now, the National Centre for Biotechnology Information. And that's not good enough. And the reason it's not good enough, people looked. If you go through papers, and the paper I cite there did this, only 8% of the scientific claims made in the body of the full paper actually appeared in the abstracts. If all you could read was abstracts, you'd miss 92% of the interesting findings. So that's clearly not at all satisfactory. And if you're a numerical biologist like I am, though nobody ever puts numbers into the abstracts because that's not very interesting to read. And so what the availability of open access allows is grown-up modern text mining methods that allow essentially computers to read, inverted commas if you will, these two papers a minute being published in biomedicine and the five per minute being published elsewhere. And there's three steps to text mining. I actually happen to work with the people in the National Centre for Text Mining in Manchester. The first is retrieving the information in the first place, and that, of course, is what requires the open access to be done. Second is using computer methods to extract the facts from the material, information extraction, and finally, a data mining phase in which you use genuine semantic techniques so that the computer actually understands that, say, glucose is not a string of seven letters that just spells G-L-U-C-O-S-E, but has a lot of baggage attached to it. It's a sugar, it's a substrate for an enzyme, and so forth. So that you can reason computationally about the thing. And that's where all the really exciting stuff is going to happen. So I mentioned this National Centre for Text Mining. They, and many other similar things, have a load of wonderful tools that are starting to allow you to do this kind of stuff, except mainly, of course, at the moment, they can only work on the abstracts because they don't have access to the full papers. And there's a list of tools there. But you can read all of those at their website. Finally, just a comment. So before I went off to work at BBSRC, I started reading about a particular topic, which was the role of iron in human disease. And I started accumulating papers. You can imagine it took me a long time, because that top one has 2,500 references. Even towards the end of this, and I had to download them one at a time the hard way, even towards the end of that, I was finding reviews in major Nature Family Review journals that had not been cited by any of the other things I was reading and did not cite them. The literature is completely siloed for a whole bunch of identifiable reasons. Open access to all of this material is going to allow us to do something about that. That's why the opportunities are very exciting indeed. In conclusion, in the research councils, we are trying to implement the Finch recommendations, and I think we're doing so both with momentum and with money, putting it where our mouth is, if you will. I've explained why we're all keen on the CC BY license for gold open access, because that essentially allows you to do anything you like and really buys you better science, which is what, from a research funder's point of view, and also from an academic's point of view, is what we want to be doing. I've stressed that it's a journey, not a fixed point. There will undoubtedly be a lot of discussions. I've certainly stressed the strong international context because the landscape is very fluid and, as Janet said, we are only 6% of it at the moment. There are also issues around modernising copyright. There was a document from BIS just before Christmas, and there's lots of discussions going on at the EU about changing licences, and that's going to be very important to this space. But most of all, I'd like to leave you with the thought that these changes should not be seen as a threat. They should be seen as an opportunity, and that those who seize the opportunity will do better science and do better in whatever it is they're doing, if they're not scientists, but other parts of the ecosystem. And with that, I think I've landed on time.